I try to reach for you, but you have closed your mind. Whatever happened to our love? I wish I understood. It used to be so nice, it used to be so good.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Indeed so. Richard Hoagland, David Wilcock are both here. We, to this moment, have been discussing the world's oil situation. Actually, we've been talking about the alternative to that, but you're really talking about the oil situation, the desperate situation that has us in a war, has people after us, and us after them, as in a war. And it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. As you see that price at the pump go up and up and up and up, you're soon going to see our economy going down and down and down and down. That's what's at stake. Nothing less than, ultimately, our survival. And a leader in the alternative field of energy, Dr. Eugene Melnoff, has been bludgeoned to death. And that's news this night, so we've been discussing it. Listen, a programming note, I am not going to be here next weekend. Ramona and myself are going to New York, where we have been invited to see the premiere of the movie The Day After Tomorrow. And in case you've never seen what an invitation to a $125 million movie looks like, I thought I'd share it with you. So I scanned it, omitting, blacking out a little bit of the RSVP number, telephone number, which I don't think you could have read anyway. But I thought you'd be interested to see what an invitation of that sort would look like. And that's what's up on the webcam tonight. So we'll be attending that next weekend, and on the 24th, actually, in New York, instead of being here. So this time next week, I'll be well on my way to New York City for that event. Once in a lifetime kind of deal, really. So I wanted you to know next week, and I believe that we'll have one replay, and then Barbara Simpson will be here for the other evening. All right, in a moment, back to our guests, Richard C. Hoagland and David Wilcock. Stay right there. Once again, my guests, Richard C. Hoagland and David Wilcock. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program. All right, look, I do want to get off a little bit on what we had, what we were going to discuss. Strangely, in a lot of ways, it's not that far off the mark anyway.
It's absolutely incredibly on point.
It really is. Yeah, here's what I want, Richard. Look, okay. We've got a neighborhood. We're Earth. We can look at Mars, and we're looking very hard at Mars now. You know what, Richard, there's something else I want to settle just before we even get into all of this, and that is, for a few weeks or months now, the audience has featured or believes that we have a feud going on, and it's not true. At least I don't think it's true, not on my part. What I did do,
either.
I went on the air and said, with regard to some photographs that had gone up, that, you know what, I'm sorry, I see rocks. And then I hadn't heard from you in a while. And, you know, two-dimensional me, I'm not changing that. Some of the things that you pointed out is possibly, I don't know, the various different artifacts that
junk.
You see. I don't see the same junk. I see rocks. and I still just see rocks. But we have had no feud that I'm aware of going on. I'm sure word of my saying that reached you.
yes, it
but,
did.
But then again, that's not really anything new between us.
But Art, just because you remember what you told me the night the first image of the face on Mars, full face, came in?
Yes.
In 2001?
I'm not talking about the face now.
I know, but
yes.
Remember what you told me.
Yes.
You know, you said hang it up, get another job, go into Storm Windows.
Oh,
it's
you mean,
over.
Well, you mean the cat box picture?
No, this was the one in 2001, the full face image. I can play the tape.
Well, okay. That may well be too.
In a reasoned reconsideration, going back and looking and thinking, you came around to the other night I heard you say, the damn thing is cat-like on the one side and monkey-like on the other.
Yeah, that's right. That's
well,
right.
It only took you 3 years, Art. So I'm a very patient person. You know, I figure if you can't see what I see as soon as I see it, just give you time. All right.
So anyway, so they know there was no feud.
No, there are people out there that I'm sure would love to create a feud.
Yeah, they always do that.
You know?
But it just hasn't happened.
And when David and I cooked up this little thing we're going to do tonight, the first person I picked up the phone and called was you, because you and I started this on the air many, many years ago, discussing the backdrop to the new physics that Gene Maloff gave his life for, which is a complete revolution in the paradigm that is not being discussed in any mainstream halls, any mainstream venues. In fact, what I like to do to kind of intro this section of the program tonight is to read a short section, and I know you hate reading, but...
Yeah, I do, and I just want to set this up,
Well, let me tell you what I wanted to read, and then you can decide.
Yes.
This is Gene's last editorial, which is so incredibly prescient. It's almost like he knew he wasn't going to be with us.
Read it.
And I'm sitting here holding it in my lap, reading it again.
Go ahead and read it.
For the second time.
Right, just do it.
Okay. He calls it breakthrough. Science censorship, the invisible evil. The Spirit and Opportunity rovers on Mars have left their landing cocoons and are exploring the surface of an alien world that has been long captivating the human imagination. The robotic laboratories are sending back spectacular imagery and other data, which, thanks to the Internet, give scientists and lay people around the world an unprecedented chance to explore vicariously another planet. There is no doubt that this is a huge accomplishment. It demonstrates progress in technological sophistication, in astronautics, communications, computer technology, and robotics, applied toward valuable ends to learn about another world by touching it from afar. The success of the latest Martian initiative might suggest to some that all is well in the halls of science. Everything is working as planned. New vistas are opening up. We may soon be confronted with further evidence that Mars harbors some kind of life, or perhaps once had living things that left remains. Mm-hmm. Science has triumphed. We are collectively experiencing the fruits of over four centuries of revolutionary scientific progress. There appears to be no obvious evidence of science censorship in these missions. Everyone gets to see pretty much all the data all at once in nearly real time. Wonderful. But beneath this triumph of the extension of human exploration stands another reality about science, one that is not pleasant to contemplate. Just at this moment of success, for those of us who most of our lives have dreamed of Martian vistas opening up, we are now all too aware of how much more human beings would be accomplishing at this time, and how fantastically better off civilization would be were we allowed to use collectively all of our faculties and powers of reason. But isn't science supposed to be one of the most liberating endeavors? How can I claim that we are not being allowed to use all our faculties and powers toward making a better world? Easy. If there is even one choke point at which such appropriate information about scientific discoveries is withheld or diminished, the community of scientists and the supportive citizenry who fund their work publicly and privately are defrauded. Sadly, today, such a choke point exists. It is the routine censoring of scientific information that does not conform to dominant scientific paradigms of the day.
That's Eugene Malov brutally...
And then he went on to detail what exactly he was talking about.
Brutally murdered today in Connecticut. All right, Richard. We are exploring Mars. We ultimately will explore our other planets. We have neighbors. They are these planets that we can look to. If we're trying to figure out what might happen to Earth, or what has happened to Earth, or even how we got here, the whole mess, then we've got to study our neighbors. And as we study our neighbors, we come to certain conclusions. And I think that's kind of the center of where we are tonight. What is it that we know about Mars or any of our other planets, our close neighbors, that gives us clues about our own situation?
Well, the thing that brought Gene and me together and David Wilcock is a kind of a common thread, which is exploration on the cutting edge of the unknown. When we tripped over the Cydonia problem, you know, decades ago now, two decades ago, and tried to unravel, you know, if it was real and then what did it mean, one of the key things that I figured out with the help of Errol Turin and some other folks is that there appeared to be a message left in the ruins of an ancient Martian civilization at a place called Cydonia on Mars. And that message had to do with the underpinnings of reality, how physics really works, what relates us as conscious beings on this planet to stars, the galaxy, energy processes, possible technologies that don't use oil. The whole nine yards appeared to be in those geometric formation.
How do you get that out of that, Richard? How do you get from there to there? In other words, if you would.
Well, in the simplest possible nutshell, we found that the structures around the face on Mars were not in random order. They appeared to have a very precise geometric pattern.
Meaning?
Meaning they were laid out...
I understand that. Meaning what, though?
Well, what we then discovered was this geometry was not just any old geometry, but appeared to be a geometry that was the underpinnings of physics in the 19th century. And that physics talked not about quantas and, you know, zero-point energy and things that go bump in the night that can't be measured, like, you know, Einstein number of dimensions that can never be tested. It talked about higher dimensions that could be tested, where energy could flow from higher dimensions into our dimension and literally create all of the reality that we see.
Well, that's pretty wild, but I don't understand what in the geometry tells you that story.
That's where things get complicated, and that's where websites come in and books and 20 years of teaching people. So I don't want to, you know, we can do that as we go through this set of examples of things we're finding in the solar system now. I don't want to bog down people with a tutorial, all right? I want to get to the good
stuff.
But
that's an incredible statement to make.
Well,
the
incredible part of the statement is that the same geometry that mathematicians and physicists were working with, leading to higher dimensional possibilities, people like Riemann back in the 19th century, is the same geometry we found apparently encoded in the set of ruins on the planet Mars. That's why I have said for a long time, Art, that I would be willing to bet anybody anything that this is real.
David, how do you fit into this at this point? I mean, where do you fit in here?
Well, here's a kid 19 years old who reads Monuments of Mars and has his world completely turned upside down because everything that he'd taken to be reality is suddenly called into question. There is a series of relationships between clearly artificial monuments on the Cydonia Plateau.
Right.
Which demonstrate angular relationships, certain specific angles, such as 19.5 degrees, and those angles correspond to a particular form of geometry. So I spent years and years of my life with, at the forefront of my mind, Hoagland's model, thinking about how geometry could be affecting planets. Because the basic bottom line...
Let's tell everybody a little bit about 19.5. There is something that anybody can demonstrate to themselves, and that is that at about the 19.5 degree point on either side of center of a planet, you can observe very unusual things, evidence of energy within the planets at that 19.5 degree point. Is that accurate?
Absolutely.
It goes all the way from the sun through all the solid planets, the ones that, you know, like Earth that we live on, or Mars, to the big gas giant planets like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. You find the largest energy upwelling on these planets at 19.5 degrees.
Which is this hyperdimensional point that you're always telling us about, and you believe a source of energy for not just our planet but all planets.
Well,
right?
It wasn't a matter of belief. It was when we saw this geometry, this pattern. Remember, all science starts with just seeing a pattern.
Yes.
Then we started asking questions of people that I knew, experts in various fields. What did this pattern mean? Did anybody ever notice this pattern anywhere before? And it was my friend Stan Tenen at the Meru Foundation, you know, who's been working on biblical texts for years and years.
Yes.
Who said, oh, that pattern is found in Coxeter and several other eminent mathematicians, and it relates to hyperdimensional models, models of higher state spaces, higher realities that cannot be seen or touched or tasted, but can be modeled mathematically as an abstract theory, and had been used as part of the cornerstone of 19th century physics, when physics was just being born by people, giants, people like Faraday and others.
Is it your position, Richard, that the energy at this point, this hyperdimensional point that you're always talking about,
mm-hmm.
Is the source energy of much of the so-called free energy tapping?
That's what brought us and Gene together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because when I laid out my take on this, and he came at it from 20th century physics, and he began to see more and more anomalies. That was the beginning of our conversation, because what I said to him point blank one day was, Gene, I don't think cold fusion is fusion at all. I think
right.
it is something different, something more fundamental, something revolutionary, something potentially hyperdimensional, something that is transmitted from another dimension and appears in our dimension as an anomalous energy source under certain conditions.
But people can see this, is what I'm trying to get through to them. If you look at the 19.5 place on a planet,
yep.
that much is obvious.
Oh, yeah.
And
any
confirmed...
planet, just go look at a map of the planets. Go to NASA's website and download some of those stunning
right.
globes.
Right. I take it this hit you as well, David, reality.
Yeah. You look on Venus, you have these two volcanoes at 19.5. You look
right.
on Mars, you got Olympus Mons, three times the size of Mount Everest, which is not only at 19.5, but is precisely 120 degrees west of the face. And 120 degrees is exactly where the other tip of the tetrahedron would be.
It's more of the same geometry.
Yeah, and then it goes on to the great red spot on Jupiter, which has been stable for at least 300 years. Uranus has a great dark spot.
Yeah, all of this is true, folks. Check it out yourself. So there is something special about that.
And in the solar cycle, the 11-year solar cycle that you're so in love with, Art.
Well, it's a love-hate relationship,
that's right.
Richard.
Okay, I found years ago in an old Scientific American one of the key solar experts, a guy named Parker. I'm sorry, his name is Parker, who published that the peak latitude of sunspots when the cycle peaks every 11 years plus or minus,
mm-hmm.
19.5 degrees. Then I found people, when I started talking about this on the air, you know, on your show and other shows, sending me little technical papers. Like, we have an electrojet phenomenon that upper atmosphere scientists at NASA at Goddard have been watching for years. Guess where the electrojets are marking, you know, like, they're like super altitude jet streams, except they're electrified. 19.5 degrees north and south. More and more and more examples of this, you know, coming up over and over again, to where I finally said, okay, this has got to be where we went wrong. 19th century physics somehow got suborned. We took the wrong path, and we went down the left road in the canyon instead of the right road out to the plain. If the 19th century physicists had stayed on course, stayed the course, as George Bush Sr. would say,
mm-hmm.
we would have free energy today. We would not have our guys and women dying in Iraq. We would not have bin Laden at our doorstep. The World Trade Towers would still exist. They might be five times taller and made out of amazing materials, because with this kind of energy, you can do astonishing technological things. We would probably have a garden on Earth. We would probably, you know, be able to feed everybody that's here and those that are coming. But in other words, it's the kind of vision that Mayloff had that the new energy age, when people embrace the real physics and applied it to a real technology, that liberate us from this albatross of oil could give to every human being on this planet. And what astonished me, and, you know, was part of our discussion for years and years and years, as he fought me that we had found the keys to this in a bunch of ruins on another planet, to my intense gratification, the day that I talked to Gene, 2-3 days before he died, he acknowledged to me that Cydonia is real, they're about to announce life on Mars, and the physics that I've been talking about as behind the free energy technologies that he has on tap is probably what's causing it to work.
All right. Both of you hold on. God knows the world does need a very fast change, doesn't it? I think everybody out there sort of knows that in the pit of their stomach, in your gut, you know it, right? That we've got to initiate a change and that it's got to come very, very soon. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Tomorrow night at this time, Dr. Michio Kaku is going to be my guest. He's certainly a proponent of the idea that there are multi-dimensions. In fact, the very best theoretical physicists of our time believe that there are as many as 11 dimensions. Now, if you've been struggling, as I always have, to understand what Richard calls hyperdimensional physics, maybe we can explain it. We can give it a try anyway. Kind of on the way there now, if you consider all of these worlds that do have an anomalous amount of energy that you can see, or a major flaw, or something at the 19.5 giveaway point. Even our own Earth. We'll get to that in a moment. At one moment, there is something very mysterious about all of these things on all of these planets. And by the way, even the Sun, I believe, at 19.5, and even our own Earth. Is that correct, Richard? What do we have at 19.5 here on Earth that would be...
Well, we have Hawaii. We have the Big Island and the Big Volcano on Hawaii, which is analogous to Olympus Mons on Mars.
So you're saying the energy is being
dispersed?
There is
an upwelling. There is a plume of lava.
Yes.
Because we're on Earth, we can actually, we got ground truth, we can measure this.
What about 19.5? Everybody knows about Hawaii. As you continue around the world, are there more remarkable?
Well, no, because what happens is you get a consolidation of the energy upwellings in a physical form, like a vortex or a volcano, into one biggie. But if you look at earthquake data, seismic data, we know that there's a plume of hot lava coming up from the outer core of the Earth, 1,800 miles straight up under Hawaii. And this plume of energy is like an arrow coming up from the core of the Earth, bursting through the crust at 19.5. And because of plate tectonics, because of the motion of the crust of the Earth across the Earth, laterally, like ships in the night, the upwelling punches through the crust at different positions and creates the different islands. And if you actually unroll the film, if you reel back time and look at where the islands were, you know, millions of years ago, you find that it's almost like you had a cigarette under a sheet of paper, and you burned a little hole in the paper.
Mm.
Then you move the cigarette, or you move the paper, and you burn another mark, and then another.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this linear chain of upwellings that burst through the surface.
At 19.5.
At 19.5, because the latitude is fixed relative to the pole.
Gotcha. What about our sun, Richard? Does it also have anomalies at 19.5?
As I said in this paper, this critical paper I found a few years ago by Parker, who was the first to notice this. He was a big solar expert in the 1950s. He noted that the peak of the sunspot cycle occurred with sunspots, which are not all over the sun equally. They basically start at about 30, 40 degrees north latitude, and as the cycle progresses, they winch their way down, a term I use very specifically, toward the equator from both sides, the north pole of the sun, the south pole of the sun. And at the peak of the sunspot cycle, which is every 11 years, they peak at about 19.5 degrees north and south latitude on the sun.
So are we, when we discuss this hyperdimensional physics, are we discussing a universal truth, a truth attributed to every body in motion, the sun, the earth, Mars, all the planets?
All the individual spinning planets in this solar system, the solar system itself, all the other stars and potential solar systems that we're finding. I mean, I could, you know, bore you with
You don't have to. I said, is it a universal?
Yes, it appears to be universal.
Right.
And what I've been trying to do for the last, 10 years or so is to quietly accumulate more and more mainstream scientific evidence, observational evidence, which basically confirms the theory, the model.
Okay. This is observable. Everybody in the audience who cares to try and prove it to themselves can about this 19.5.
Oh, it's
point on every
pattern.
Planet, but it's something we can actually see, we can verify for ourselves.
Yep.
It seems very much this dimensional, at least the effects of it.
The effects are, of course, in this dimension, because this is where we live. But the cause is not in this dimension, and that's where we go back to the 19th century mathematicians like Cayley and physicists like Faraday and
Whitaker.
David, good.
Maxwell is the other guy.
Maxwell, yes, all right, fine. David, you were a student of Richard's. You read his book. You obviously are on fire about...
A distant student.
the meaning of all of this.
We never talked until a couple of years ago.
That's correct, yeah.
But, I mean, in the middle of all this is big stuff. Where do you fit? Kind of give me an idea.
Well, what I basically saw was that there was room for the hyperdimensional model to expand. And Richard works on a number of different areas of inquiry, all of which are very important, very fruitful. And I've pretty much chosen to focalize on just the physics.
Mm-hmm.
And where we stand tonight is truly a magnificent place because Richard essentially gave me an assignment, and I completed the assignment, and it's an astonishing body of data that we've come up with, which is showing that the entire solar system, not just at any one point like 19.5, but the planets themselves, and in many cases their moons, are showing dramatic signs of energetic increase, which include increasing atmospheric pressure, increasing brightness from the aurora borealis, increasing magnetic field strength, increasing cataclysmic activity in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I can stand here tonight and basically say to you, name a planet, and I'll tell you what's changing about it. It doesn't even matter which one you pick because we've got data for every single one.
Mars.
From the mid-1970s to 1997, on the Hubble Telescope website, the director of NASA at the time, Dr. Don Savage, said that between the late 1970s and 1997, Mars had developed clouds, had lost most of its dust, and had picked up a surprise abundance of ozone. Now, one of the things we're talking about in this model has to do with the emergence of this charged energy, like ozone, or plasma, as it's called, this luminous sea of electrons and protons. This is a sign in this new model of a higher degree of energy that's bleeding through to the third dimension. The Mars Surveyor probe was orbiting Mars in 1997 and encountered in one area a 200% increase in the atmospheric pressure from what was expected there.
At a couple hundred miles altitude.
And there's nothing to account for these changes in this dimension. In other words, we can't look at the sun and see more output, or is there anything? I'm looking for physical things that we can say account for this change, for example, in Mars. I've even heard there's global warming going on on Mars. That is
correct. Yeah, I mean, the irony is that all of this data is being released with conventional-sounding explanations.
All right. What would be a conventional-sounding explanation for global warming on Mars? I'd be very interested in that.
It has to do with the ice caps, the regions that are at the poles being tilted more towards the sun. And they claim that because that's going on, that it warms up the planet and melts the ice caps.
And they are melting, aren't they? They are melting,
oh,
right?
Oh, dramatically so, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, the problem is that the timescales don't fit. There is something on Mars, on Earth, and many other planets called obliquity shifts. The tilt of a planet's spin to its orbit around the sun is called its obliquity.
Yes.
For the Earth, it's 23.5 degrees. For Mars, it's 25 degrees. For Jupiter, it's around 3 degrees. For Saturn, it's about 27. You know, you all see models of the solar system where you have these little canted planets rakishly tilted
sure.
to the orbit around the sun.
Absolutely.
Planets' obliquities change over time. In mainstream models, this is probably due to gravitational and tidal effects between planets, even over millions of miles. That's a small point of contention, but let's assume that's true. What it means is that you can construct models in the computer which will predict, you know, from here forward or from here back, you know, a million years ago, 5 million years ago, 20 million years ago, what the tilt of the planet would be, and the effect of that on the total solar insulation of the planet, how much energy is absorbed and reflected, and what it would do to the planetary climate.
All right, Richard, hold tight for a second. David?
Yes.
Venus.
Venus. Between 1978 to 1983, the amount of sulfur gases in Venus's atmosphere, according to Bullock and Grinspoon in Scientific American magazine, decreased dramatically. I'll say that again. The amount of sulfur gas, obviously smells like rotten eggs, decreased dramatically between 1978 to 83.
Mm-hmm.
A parallel study was done between the Russian probes known as the Venera that visited Venus in 1975, and then with our ground-based Keck telescopes in 1999, there was a difference noticed between the amount of brightness. There's this green light that shows up in Venus's atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
In 1975, they didn't see it at all. And in 1999, it was 2,500% brighter. So this is an enormous change.
2,500%.
An increase in energy.
Actual physical green light.
It's the green line of oxygen. It's the same line that's in the air glow mm-hmm. over the Earth. Now, here's the weird part. The Earth's oxygen atmosphere is like 20%, right?
Right.
Yes.
There's supposed to be no oxygen on Venus at all. So where in the space of a few years, did more oxygen come from in the upper Venus atmosphere than is present in the upper terrestrial atmosphere?
And where did all the sulfur go?
These are Genesis-like changes.
Huge.
We're talking
huge.
About the whole world's atmosphere all at once having a dramatic decline in sulfur in 5 years.
Got it.
And they initially pegged this to a mysterious massive volcanic eruption
right.
that must have taken place on Venus, except, of course, Art, there's no data. There were no observations of any volcanoes by any spacecraft or terrestrial instruments of Venus ever in the history of observing Venus. They simply waved their magic wand, this is the NASA guys, and said, oh, it had to be a volcano, because what else could it be?
Right.
The problem in science is the what else could it be. This is what Jean Mayloff was fighting against, because the what else is what leads us to new territory, new discoveries, and new progress.
David?
Yes.
Jupiter.
Oh, man. Jupiter is just incredible. There is this donut-shaped cloud of energy that goes around in the orbit of the moon Io, which is the closest moon to Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
This cloud didn't even show up at all as of 1974. As of 1979, there's this donut luminous cloud showing up around Jupiter. And then between 1979 to 1995, the cloud becomes 200% brighter and denser. At the same time, the moon Io becomes 1,000% higher in its ionosphere, which is where the charge energy goes. It was originally measured in 1973 at between 30 and 60 miles. In 1996, it was at 555 miles. That was from Dr. Lewis Frank from NASA. The surface of Io is actually three times hotter than the surface of Mercury. Okay, now Mercury is right next to the Sun. But here's Io hanging out around Jupiter, three times hotter than the surface of Mercury, and it increased in its temperature by over 200% between 1979 and 1998.
And that's not counting the volcanoes.
Boy.
Right.
Boy, oh boy. Are you beginning to see a commonality here, folks?
And I'm telling you, just pick a planet. It doesn't even matter.
Saturn.
Saturn. There is an aurora that was first seen, this glowing luminous energy, seen for the first time in 95 at the polar regions. Some weird stuff is going on there. I found one study from Dr. Ed Sittler et al. That shows that between 1981 and 1993, a donut of energy very similar to the one we see around Jupiter, similar one around Saturn, had become 1,000% more dense and bright.
Wow.
These are global changes of geological proportion occurring in just years, Art.
Yeah.
Not thousands of years or millions of years.
Just years.
But stunningly short periods of time.
12 years in this case.
I've got it. That is very fast indeed. All right. David, Earth.
All kinds of good stuff. In 1998, the Van Allen belts had a new belt of energy that showed up for the first time. And this was something that had never been seen before. It was basically where you have I'll read you the quote. It says, "Activity in Earth's two known Van Allen radiation belts grew so intense in May 1998 that a new belt was created which generated excitement and awe in the scientific community." And as we go on, we had Richard and you talking back in February 96, and I was a listener at that time, about this tethered satellite.
That's right.
Remember that one?
Clearly.
It melts, and, you know, it's this satellite. Just for the reader's sake, I'll say that it's this satellite that's attached to this very thin wire.
Listeners.
Stretches out for a long way, and it just burned up. And NASA had built this thing supposedly foolproof, and I found one article on CNN that was linked from these other articles that said that the tether was foolproof. And, of course, when you try to link on that one, it's no longer there, and Google doesn't have it either.
Well, it didn't just burn up. And, Mark, this is a vivid recollection down memory lane, because after they deployed it, remember, it was built by the Italians. It had this highly instrumented satellite at the end of this very long wire. They kind of unreeled it from a fishing reel kind of thing in the cargo bay. And mile after mile after mile, it got out to its farthest deployment, and they were coming over the terminator between the sunset and nighttime side of the Earth, and it was exactly at the terminator, over the evening terminator, that something happened, and they got a massive surge of current, thousands of times what they had modeled, expected from their computer calculations based
on
other physics.
That's true.
And the tether burned through. They had a press conference shortly thereafter, and the guys inside, the astronauts, looked like Bambi in the headlights. They looked terrified, because you can imagine a several-mile-long piece of wire snapping back and forth that would have sliced the shuttle in two.
Yeah, they damn near lost it, actually.
They almost lost it. They also, and this was not reported, they had massive power surges on other instruments, onboard computers. They lost two out of the three backup computers. They almost did not make it home. But no one to this day at NASA will acknowledge where all the excess energy came from. And remember that night that we had on Bruce De Palma from Australia?
Yes.
Or from New Zealand?
Yes, yes.
And we talked about the De Palma experiments in the end machine?
Right.
If you rotate a conductor at high speed, even in the presence of no magnetic field, it develops a charge at the rim, and you can pull electron current off the rim if you put a connector between the pole and the rim.
So yeah, it kind of works like a lawn sprinkler.
Yeah, this goes back to Faraday in 1835, back to the 19th century physics again, which is called a homopolar generator and does not conform to any known physics.
Well, they obviously got far more than they expected.
It was a free energy device. It was an orbital free energy device, and the guys who built it didn't know what was going to happen, and so they almost fried seven astronauts.
Yes, I know.
Now, here's the bottom line on that.
How does the extra energy that they experienced fit into your model?
Because it's like a giant end machine. It's like what's going on with the rings of Saturn, which we're going to get back to in a second. If you have a rotating object in orbit around the Earth, or you have the Earth itself, you know, you, by the way, have your own little hyperdimensional experiment going on there out in the desert.
Yes.
You have this antenna that you've been talking about loud and long.
I know.
You've got a mile or so of wire in, what, two tiers?
Yeah, that's right.
Lofted a couple hundred feet in the air?
Not a couple hundred feet. 75 feet and 68,
okay,
respectively, but a mile of wire,
okay,
yes.
Okay, you have got a conductor suspended above the planet on a rotating ball. You have a miniature free energy end machine generator. Because it has nothing to do with air electricity.
I know.
It's not cutting through the Earth's magnetic field. It's moving with the field.
Okay. Richard, we've got to hold it right there. Well, you know, I can confirm certain aspects of that. That energy is there in AC and DC components on a clear, windless day. Just to preclude a lot of, you know, well, you're just getting static kind of calls. I've tested and tested again, and I'm telling you right now that energy is there on a clear, windless, sunny, beautiful, still birds chirping kind of day. So there you are. I don't know what it is that I've got. I guess Richard thinks he knows, but I can tell you it's real. From the high desert in the middle of the night, this is Coast to Coast AM.